Hey, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the July 5th edition of The Other Animals. I'm your host, Laurent Levy. I hope everyone had a wonderful 4th and that your dogs and cats weren't too terrified. We have a very, I hope will be a very inspirational show today. We'll start with neurologist and author Aisha Akhtar, and then later on we'll be joined with by Clarissa Black from Pets and Vets. I'm hoping that since this is a holiday weekend, that we might have some new listeners who we might not otherwise have, who after all might have real jobs that don't necessarily approve of talk radio in the office. If you are new, let me just give you a little intro what this show is about. We're trying to figure out the very weird way we humans deal and interact with all the non-humans around us. I try not to be preachy, but you know, some of that creeps in from time to time. But I do always keep an open mind as much as possible. It's a wild and diverse and above all inconsistent thing, this relationship we have with all the non-humans out there. I can assure you of that. We have some of the most fascinating guests you'll ever hear, including today, absolute leaders in their fields. And each week I'm joined by veterinarian Dr. Tom Picard, who can answer any of your pet questions on the air, submitted by email or text, or even live if you'd like to call in at 888-329-3306. So Tom, how are we doing? How was your 4th?
Oh, it was pretty good. Just got a little break to the shore, and but couldn't really do too much because the sand and is not my friend of my leg.
Yeah, how are we doing with that? It's coming along.
Little by little.
The attack of the grill.
Little by little.
So what can, you know, we probably should have done this a little bit last week, but, you know, there still will be some more fireworks this weekend. You know, that a lot of places around here do them all throughout the weekend. What's the best advice you can give to pet owners? Because they freak out. Dogs and cats just totally go nuts with fireworks. What's the best thing?
Yeah, a lot of them do. In fact, they think, you know, about 40% of dogs suffer from it. And it's, you know, it can be a pretty serious problem because some of them can really, you know, hurt themselves and they're just completely stressed out of their minds. So, you know, if they have some underlying disease problem, this does not help the situation. And it's, you know, it's stressful, of course, for the owner too, to see their animals stressed. So there's a number of medications that have come out on the market in the past few years. Some I've got, I the name off the top of my head escapes me at the moment, it'll come to me, but a little bit of help has been had from some of these. Previously vets used to just sedate them, which is you know, that
I'm really. I thought you were going to say, you know, to keep them in the basement or something away, but to actually medicate.
Yeah, I mean, hiding them. There doesn't seem to be any place they can really hide, just because they can hear so much better than we can. I mean, people can do some non-invasive things like putting up the music, nice music louder in their house, you know, or the TV or something like that. Often dogs can still hear it anyway. They just have so much better sense of it. They probably feel it coming too, the pressure changes and things like that. So they know, and they start probably pacing long before we know there's thunder coming. But there are drugs that sometimes do help that are not as strong as tranquilizers, which I don't think are really the best thing to use because you're just sedating them. They're still in fear and still have the phobia.
Do they react? It's curious now if we're mixing thunderstorms and weather phenomena versus fireworks. Right? Do they have a different response to them?
Oh yeah, I guess I am mixing them. No, because I'm mixing them because they are pretty much the same.
Yeah,
okay. Thunder and fireworks are just probably the same.
I was gonna say, there's no if the dogs are sensing pressure change with fireworks, like
No, I did confuse that. Yeah, no, the fireworks are just, you know, they're just occasional thing, but thunder's going to be an all time summer thing and other months too. So. They do make these coats I've seen recently. It's kind of like a Velcro coat you can put on your dog that gives them sort of a sensation of being hugged in a way, something they do maybe akin to like maybe some autistic children and things like that. They sometimes hugging them helps. Sometimes it doesn't. Some of them don't respond to that sort of a thing.
And what do the drugs do? I mean,
there's a number of homeopathic medications that are quote unquote calming agents. I'm really not sure what they are, but you know, some people prefer that sort of thing, really minuscule doses of natural compounds, and you probably have to experiment a lot with those things.
Like really stoner dogs or whatever, but
well, they do. Some of them will use CBD oils and things like that. Some people seem, I know people have used it in cases I've used for even, you know, just pain and things like that from disease problems. And they said they do sleep really pretty well on CBD oils. So it's another safe option to try for animals too.
You know. All right. So speaking of medication, I read this week there is an issue with, among others, a particular type of flea repellent. The one that's Simparica is the one that I read about, but I think there are others. And apparently it's causing seizures in dogs. What's going on with that?
In some, yes. There's so many flea and tick medications out there. This one is Simparica and Bravecta and a bunch of others. The ones to look to avoid right now are these ones that are taken internally as opposed to the topical medications you put right on their skin and really aren't absorbed into the body. Okay. They just kind of go through the coat oils. They're the ones I prefer. Frontline, Advantage are those types. There's some other ones like that. If you take a pill or some sort of other compound internally, I'm just not a big fan of that. Yeah. If you can avoid them, it's all the better. What's happening with, they think, with these is that the way it kills the fleas and ticks is that it disrupts their neurotransmissions. It affects their glutamic acid and other neurotransmitters in their body, and they're seeing possibly in some dogs that they're just hypersensitive to it. And even though it's such a small amount of these compounds, it's affecting their nervous system too.
Okay. So basically stay away from the orals until
we... I think so.
Okay. All right. Well, as I said, I did read that in the news, which means that as smooth a segue as possible, that it's time now for our weekly segment of Animals in the News. Okay, our first story today, kind of sad. Comes to us from San Diego. A toddler dies from E. coli linked to contact with animals at the San Diego County Zoo. It was a 2-year-old boy died from complications of E. coli, and 3 other children were sickened in cases that officials said were linked to contact with animals at the San Diego County Fair in June. 4 children ages 2 to 13 visited the fair from June 8th to June 15th and exhibited symptoms of Shiga toxin-producing E. coli from June 10th to 16th, the County of San Diego Health and Human Services Agency said in a news release last Friday. The 2-year-old died on June 24th from complications of the bacteria. The other 3 children who were sickened were not hospitalized. Their conditions were not immediately available as of last Sunday. The fair features more than 2,900 animals and numerous activities, including pig races and livestock shows with calves, rabbits, pigeons, and goats. The fair shut public access to animals last week, and on Sunday it began removing them from the fairgrounds. So there's a little bit there, besides the obviously we hope the rest of the children are fine. It's sad about the child, but there is, is it really the right thing to be doing to be having races, pig races? Does that really have a place in our society in this day and age? Next story is sort of a follow-up to what we were talking with a couple weeks ago when we had Jeff Lockwood on here. And this is interesting. Cockroaches could soon be almost impossible to kill. Cockroaches have become harder to kill and soon could be almost impossible to control using pesticides alone, according to a study funded by the United States Housing Department. Researchers from Purdue University in Indiana spent 6 months trying to eradicate German cockroaches, known as Blotella germanica L, one of the most common species of household cockroaches in the U.S., Australia, and Europe, from 3 low-rise buildings in Illinois and Indiana. Laboratory tests showed that cockroaches were able to develop a cross-resistance to multiple types of pesticides, meaning that those which survived the spraying of one would go on to survive other eradication attempts, even if a different class of pesticide was used. Rapid breeding rates, a female cockroach can have 50 offspring every 3 months, expanding out to up to 10 million descendants over 4 generations within 12 months, and that means that chemical pesticides can swiftly become ineffective. Cockroaches developing resistance to multiple classes of insecticides at once will make controlling these pests almost impossible with chemicals alone, the representative from the study said. He said pest controllers would have to use a mix of traps, improve sanitation in housing departments, and bug vacuums to reduce cockroach numbers. I confess I've never seen a bug vacuum, and I'm probably the better off for it. Our final story comes from Japan. Japan resumed commercial whale hunting on Monday after a hiatus of more than 30 years. defying calls from conservation groups to protect animals once hunted to the brink of extinction. Now whalers who have long depended on government subsidies for their survival face the much tougher challenge of defying basic economic reality. The market for their product is declining, while labor costs across the nation are on the rise. But for Japan, whaling has long been about more than economics. Tokyo has for decades fiercely defended whale hunting, despite heavy criticism from the international community. The government and local authorities celebrate the practice as a tradition with a long history and cultural significance akin to the hunting of whales in countries such as Norway and Iceland, where commercial hunting is permitted, or among indigenous communities in the United States and Canada. So this one's worth a moment here. So this talks on some of the themes that we've been dealing with, which is the commercial and capital aspect of how we deal with animals. And normally we would say, well, if there is the best place to vote is with your wallet. If you don't promote or support the purchase of live animals or meat, well, that's going to resonate, right? In this case, there's another factor in play, and that's the cultural. So we heard in the article that there's tradition and cultural significance that appears in this case to outweigh the financial and capital aspect. So my question for anyone who wants is, when does culture and tradition give way to the realities of misery and extinction? I mean, this is a touchy one. You could say always in any situation, well, this is my culture, this is my history. I've been doing this, for how many hundreds of years, and who are you to come in and try to impact my way of life? And then the other argument is, well, the suffering and the misery of the individual. What, pick your animal? Is it a whale? Is it a calf? Is it a goat? Whatever it could be, doesn't that outweigh? Doesn't that have a factor? When does the culture not outweigh the misery? Food for thought. All right. If you're around for Memorial Day, we took a rather ominous look at the murky history of animals in warfare. For Independence Day, we'll revisit the subject of animals and the military, but this time from the surprising way animals can tap into our capacity for compassion and empathy, and to those soldiers and others who have confronted stress and abuse, overcome, restore, and heal. Animals, healing, and empathy, this week on The Other Animals. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
Yeah, welcome back. I'd like to read for you an excerpt from the foreword. It's actually written by Carl Sapina, of our first guest's book. Here's what it says. Humans have the capacity for compassion, so acting compassionately fulfills our human potential. The greatest realization is that all life is one. Aisha Akhtar's stories are about recovery, renewal, and hope. Be soothed by these stories and the shared destiny and healing that takes place within these pages. I think that's rather beautiful. Aisha Akhtar, MD, MPH, is a neurologist and public health specialist and is on a mission to show that what's good for animals is also good for humans. Dr. Akhtar is the author of the new book, Our Symphony with Animals, on health, empathy, and our shared destinies. Combining medicine, social sciences, and stories, her book explores how deeply the well-being of humans and animals are entwined. The book shows how humanity's compassion for animals is the next step in our species' moral evolution and a vital component of our own health. Dr. Akhtar is a fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics, is deputy director of the Army Traumatic Brain Injury Program, and serves as commander in the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. Aisha, welcome to The Other Animals.
Thanks for having me here, Lauret.
Okay. So let me just ask, are you currently on active duty?
Yes. I'm with the Public Health Service, and so with that, I am on active duty. It's one of the set of seven uniformed services.
Cool. And as an MD, you have a practice that you...
I'm not practicing. I'm working in the traumatic brain injury program at the Army. We're working on the guidelines, the policies that establish how the hospital, the physicians are to take care of patients with traumatic brain injury.
I see. Okay. Well, let me start with the book. So the book weaves your personal encounter with abuse. And how you eventually overcame this, and it's a very personal account, and it's clearly there's an influence there that moved you, I think, to write this book. I was just wondering if you could tell us how this led to sort of an epiphany regarding compassion to animals.
Sure. When I was a child, I was being sexually abused by an uncle. He was actually more of a family friend, but we called him an uncle. And that went on for about 5 years. And during that time, I didn't tell anyone else what was going on. Then when I was 9 years old, so the abuse started when I was five. When I was 9 years old, my grandparents, who lived next door, adopted a dog named Sylvester. And I had never known an animal before, never a dog. And Sylvester and I just fell absolutely in love with each other. You know, we were the best of friends. And he comforted me in a way that no one else could have at the time. And there was another factor. There was something else that we shared. I came to realize that he was also being abused by another uncle who was physically abusing him as part of a training program. And for just like with my own abuse, I remained silent about Sylvester's abuse for quite some time. But the odd thing was is that at the time I was more upset about Sylvester's abuse than my own, because as vulnerable as I was at the time, I realized that Sylvester was even more powerless.
Mm-hmm.
And at some level, I think I understood that, you know, our struggles were the shared, that it was sort of the, you know, his struggle, his fight was the same as mine.
Was there a commonality with Sylvester? He really has no capacity. He is silent. He truly was powerless. Did you feel powerless at the same time? Was that the immediate bond, the sense of powerlessness to do anything about it?
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, it's hard to look back and say that consciously I felt that way, but at some level I think I did. And and I think that's why I was even more upset about Sylvester's abuse, because he had no, you know, even though I was a child, Sylvester, no one was hearing his cries either. And so ultimately what happened was that my love and my empathy for Sylvester gave me the courage to stand up, speak out, and I ended his abuse. And that eventually led to me speaking out and ending my abuse. So I realized and I recognized that it was my empathy for Sylvester and my empathy for an animal that changed my life in a very profound way. So that was the inspiration for the book. And, you know, now, as you mentioned, I'm a neurologist, and I'm looking at, in the book, how does empathy for animals affect all of us, and not just as individuals, but as a society, you know, collectively.
Mm-hmm. So empathy became, this is actually a really, I thought, a really beautiful quote from the book. Empathy is an essential component in our moral development. Without it, we are unable to imagine the lives of others and their suffering and have a desire to relieve it. So if you took the example of Sylvester, and you were actually focused on relieving his suffering, and did that momentarily by focusing on him and your sense of empathy with him distract you from your own abuse?
Yes, definitely, because his abuse was harder for me to take, mm-hmm. harder for me to understand. So, you know, for a long time, I was just thinking about what do I do about him? What do I do about Lester? How do I protect him? And I was scared to speak out. Mm-hmm. And I was also not just scared. I was, my uncle, who was abusing Sylvester, had told me that what he was doing to Sylvester was normal.
Yeah.
So when he said that it was normal, you know, I believed him. I believed that animal abuse was normal. And that was the hardest thing for me to recognize, that I was being, convinced by someone else's, you know, belief system in what is normal to do to animals. And so it was ultimately when I was able to break through that.
So that person, but that person who's telling you that it's normal, that's an adult, right? You're still a child. That's an adult. There's an authority. So you are naturally, am I right? That person was older than you, right? The person that was,
yes.
Yeah. And, so you have to accept it. We're culturally, right? That's an authority figure. And the person says it's normal. And well, then there must be something wrong with me. Why am I getting so upset? And so I feel like, you know, there's this struggle going on internally with a child, or in your situation, where you know intuitively that it's wrong, but the adult is telling you you're wrong.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And I think that's how we as a society are able to allow so much of the animal abuse that goes on, whether we're talking about in factory farms and laboratories and in other places, that we look to authority figures, whether they're researchers, whether they're, you know, business leaders, whether they're our government leaders, who are telling us that this is what we must do. So even though, you know, individually we might think that this seems so wrong, and that, you know, we intuitively cringe at what we hear about what's being done to animals, we fall into line, in a sense, because we believe what authority figures tell us. Mm-hmm.
And it's even institutionalized. I'm thinking of the story in your book of Elena Hidalgo, and she also, as a child, she grows up, and you can maybe tell the story, but she's in a area of the country where farming is just part of the culture, and she gets involved with Future Farmers of America, FFA, and they do that. The cultural indoctrination, if you will, is that you raise, in her case, a pig, and then you raise the pig to the point where it's ready to go to slaughter. And what they have to teach the child is, all right, everything you felt, all this bonding, all this love that you felt, now you have to grow up, and you have to learn that this is just temporary, and say goodbye, and the pig is going off to slaughter. Could you fill in the blanks on that story?
Yeah, so Elena, as you mentioned, she was a high school student, and this is Texas. So, yeah, definitely the heart of one of the hearts of animal agriculture in the country. And, she joined Future Farmers of America. She was so excited. She loved animals, and she wanted to, you know, thought, I get to work with a pig. She fell in love with her pig troubles. The pig fell in love with her. You know, they bonded. Pigs are like dogs in so many ways. And so, you know, she was being taught by her teachers that she needed to whip the pig as well, to whip the pig into proper posture and walking, because that's what the pig is going to be judged on at the final big agricultural fair at the end of the year. And that was the culmination of the students' program. And she refused to whip the pig. She refused to beat troubles. But at the same time, she was still going through this program, and she knew that at some point, you know, she's going to have to make some kind of decision because, you know, on one hand, she didn't want to accept that what was going to happen to troubles was going to happen. And so she tried to put that out of her mind. But ultimately what happened is that the agricultural fair, Chubbles was bought. And before Alina even knew what happened, she never even had a chance to say goodbye to Chubbles. Chubbles was, taken onto a truck and driven away. And she was devastated, absolutely devastated about the loss of her friend. And when she came the next year, in spite of that, she decided to go through the program again because she thought she could at least give another pig a good life for a time being because she was caring. And that time, then she started saying, I can't do this again. I can't, you know, love another pig and then just see the pig being, you know, sold off for slaughter or you know, for whatever other use. And she and her friend started to try to raise money to save her pig. And that became a big deal at the time. And she faced, Alina faced a lot of bullying at the time. People were making fun of her, this girl who was trying to save a pig. So it there was definitely a cultural,
she had to stand up. When she faced the first year, was she aware at some level what the destiny of Chubbles would be? Did she know, or did she not even know that Chubbles was going to be slaughtered or supposed?
She was aware. She knew what the end of the program was going to be, and she just kind of compartmentalized it in her mind.
Okay, so the moment of reality where all of a sudden she can't compartmentalize anymore. Now she's confronted with this, and she's really conflicted. And I'm thinking a child like Alina, and how old is she at this point? She's 15, something like that?
Yeah.
And this seems like every kid in this program probably has some moment like that because they've been raised from early, you know, from the beginning, this is normal. This is normal. What happens in a case like Alina or in your own case that says, no, I can't. Something snaps. Something goes the other way. What made Elena's case, why was she so unique? How did she do it?
I think part of it was that she had incredibly supportive parents.
Mm-hmm.
She had parents who weren't telling her that this is the way life is and that you have to, you know, send your pig for slaughter. She had parents who understood what her child was going through. What their child was going through, and they supported her. And they supported her when she said, I can't, when the second pig, Gizmo, came around, she said, I can't have him go to slaughter. I need to do something to try to save him. And they supported her. And I think that was also the case with me, is that I had, despite the fact that, you know, one of my uncles was abusing Sylvester, I had a very supportive family who we all felt a kinship with animals. And so so even though there were stark reminders of abuse, stark periods of abuse in our lives, we were still around families and sometimes friends who were supportive of our compassion for animals. And I think that's what made a huge difference for Alina and for me. And I will say that Alina did meet other students who ended up telling her that they felt the same thing, but they were too afraid to speak out.
She was the pioneer. Did she start it? Was there a little movement almost? Did other kids also follow her lead? Or was it just sort of a tacit, you know, an admiration?
It was more of an admiration. I think the other students were afraid because they didn't want for their friends to make fun of them and things like that. But I will say that Alina now works with the sanctuary and with other Future Farmers of America kids from different places, not just her school. She's homeschooled now, but from different places with kids who don't want to see the animals slaughtered. And so she has worked with them. So she's become a leader in her own way.
Fascinating. And again, it's the difference for her was the support system. The fact that even if her parents may not have necessarily agreed with her, and I guess her parents, in fact, may, bad pun, skin in the game, right, because they were farmers as well. They still supported her. They still supported it, and it broke the mold, it sounds, of what is and what isn't normal. That she could actually tap into that part that she knew, this is not, whether it's normal or not, it didn't matter. Normal became not the issue anymore. What became the issue was empathy, that she felt for Chubbles. She had a connection, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I just one thing before we go to a break. There's another quote that sort of leads off in this. It's from your book. All forms of abuse share a commonality. They hide behind silence. I think that's a great sentiment. Do you think that that's also true, not just of abuse, but of any personal trauma?
Oh, absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. It you know, personal trauma often is a result of abuse in some way. It could be physical abuse, mental abuse. It could be a social abuse. You know, people are traumatized by things that happen in a society where there's violence. So in that sense, there's an abuse there. And, you know, we are traumatized by the events that others experience. And so I think collectively and as individuals, the more we speak out, the more we recognize all these forms of abuse and traumas, and realize that they are ultimately connected. They are ultimately connected by a desire to, you know, violence is connected because of people who have power, who abuse others who don't have power, and by people who allow these things to happen. So in that sense, you know, Sylvester's abuse was the same as mine. It's people who allowed child abuse have to realize that at the same time we have to recognize all forms or people, you know, when we fight against child abuse, we must recognize that all forms of abuse are connected. It's the same mindset that causes abuse.
Okay. That's beautiful. All right. The book is Our Symphony with Animals, Our Unhealth, Empathy, and Our Shared Destinies. We're talking with Dr. Aisha Akhtar, the author. When we come back, we're going to see empathy and healing in action. Sort of based on what we're just talking about with trauma, this time for returning soldiers. And we'll be talking with Clarissa Black of Pets for Vets. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
And welcome back to The Other Animals on WWDB. Just a quick announcement here. The Atlantic City Vegan Food Festival and Foodie 5K is coming up next week, July 12th through 14th. Cleverly enough, it's in Atlantic City. Great food, sports, and a fitness expo, and of course, the 5K on the boardwalk. More information at sprouteverywhereevents.com. That's the Atlantic City Vegan Food Festival next weekend. My next guest is Clarissa Black. Clarissa holds a Bachelor of Science degree in Animal Science from Cornell University and a Master's in Anthrozoology from none other than Canisius College. She began her career by working with elephants and dolphins, where she learned advanced animal training principles and applied them to husbandry, veterinary research, and program training. She eventually shifted her focus to professional dog training, where she was able to apply many of these same lessons and training principles to man's and woman's best friend. In 2009, she founded Pets for Vets, Inc., which brings together two of her greatest passions, helping veterans and saving animal lives. Hey, Clarissa, welcome to The Other Animals.
Hi, thank you for having me.
How are you doing? So tell us, first of all, about Pets for Vets. Just give us the high level. What is the program, and how long has it been in operation, and how does it work?
Yes, Pets for Vets is a 501c3 national charity. We rescue shelter dogs and train them for returning veterans to help with things like post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, anxiety, and depression. And this is our 10th year, so it's a big year for us.
Congratulations. So I'm curious if you heard the first part of our conversation with Dr. Akhtar and this concept of stress and trauma, and how the dogs that you match with veterans, how that process is soothing and healing to both.
Absolutely. I could talk about this for forever.
Go for it.
So many different ways. you know, stress, trauma, PTSD, anxiety, depression, while we all know those words, they can manifest differently for different people. And dogs have this, animals in general, have this unique way of sort of offering whatever it is that particular person needs. So specifically things like the social support, it is so important for veterans who have PTSD to feel that they are part of a community, part of a network. And having an animal that has non-judgmental, that is always happy when you come home, doesn't care if you've brushed your hair or taken a shower for the day, just having that being there that loves you, as that doesn't try to offer advice, doesn't talk, just listens when you want to talk to them, is so, so important. I had a veteran who had been through 6 tours, and his particular dog had this little characteristic where he'd put his paw up on your leg or on your hand. He'd walk over and do that, and he said to me that on that very first night that he looked into his dog's soulful eyes and he put his paw on his hand, that he had this moment where he just opened up and told his dog absolutely everything he had been through that he wasn't able to tell anyone else, and he cried with his dog, and it just was what it was, that catharsis that he needed in that moment.
That's a great. Is that almost common? It seems like there is. You would almost have that ability that because the dog is confidential. There's no worry of judgment or of being disclosed. Maybe that's the word I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. That there's a safety. There's a safety in that bond. Is that what's going on? Is that what's healing? Is that?
I think that's part of it, absolutely. That when you can open up to your pet, your dog, your cat, whoever it is, that they're not going to spill your secrets. But it's also that they're able to reflect back what it is that you're presenting to them. But they're not interrupting you. They're not criticizing. They're not offering advice. They're just there, simply holding that space for the human to let that out. But it's also, important for everyone to know what we do at Pets for Vets. What makes us so unique is the way that we're actually picking the animals for the human. We're finding that the animal that wants exactly what that human has to offer, so both are getting the symbiotic benefit of that relationship mm-hmm. with each other. So we are, I've created a system where we actually get to know our veterans first, find out what it is that they're looking for in an animal, a pet, a dog, a cat, what it is, where they hope to be in their life, what those expectations are. And then we're going and asking the animals, obviously we're listening to them in a different way, but we're asking the animals a series of questions as well to find out what it is that they're looking for, how it is they express love, how they react to love, how they view the world, what it is that is going to make that animal happy. And then we're matching these two together and creating what I've coined a term called the super bond. And the super bond is this immediate visceral connection. And science has shown that having that stronger perceived connection and that stronger connection to your animal is actually what provides more mitigating feelings for things like PTSD, anxiety, depression.
What would you say to those who might challenge a little bit and say, well, maybe this is great for the vet, but is there an element here that is this necessarily good for the dog? Is it somehow that the dog is being manipulated? Have you ever gotten a reaction like that?
I think that's great. It's wonderful to think about the animals, and you need to. And that's what's so unique about Pets for Vets, is that we take both members of the dyad into consideration here. As I was saying, the way that we developed the selection process for our dogs, we're asking the dogs exactly what it is that they want. So they're getting from their human exactly what it is that they need.
How do you do
need.
That?
It's not just...
Yeah. How do you talk
to them? We don't really talk to the dogs. They actually talk to us. So we ask them a series of questions, and those questions are in the form of stimuli. So when we pet a dog, we're looking at how they respond to that pet. When we present, whatever that stimuli is, we're reading what the dog is saying to us in body language. So it's really imperative and important for all of the trainers in the Pets for Vets program to be really skilled trainers, that they have to understand body language and what it is that they're seeing. So the dogs are telling us exactly what it is they want, and we're not selecting a dog that would not want to be in the situation that we're putting them in. And so it's a system that I've created and we call it a deal breaker. If the dog is saying, no, I don't want that, then that dog isn't right for the program or for the particular person that we're looking for. It doesn't mean that the dog's not a great, wonderful, amazing pet, but we want to make sure all the animals that we're selecting are getting exactly what it is.
It has to be mutual.
For. Exactly. Right. It has to be mutual.
So let's flip over then to the other side. So from the veterans' perspective, are there different the needs are got to be very different. Some of them will have seen some really terrible things, right? As different stresses, different traumas, and is there an underlying assumption that there is no person at home for the veteran to confide in? That are they lonely? Is that sort of always there, or is it just that the person is not the same, doesn't offer the same as the dog?
I think it's a little bit of both. Sometimes it's that inability with the human to be able to express what they experienced, feeling that if they do express that then maybe they'll lose that disconnection or lose the connection with whoever that human is that is in their life. So I think that fear is there, and that's probably why it's easier to express it to an animal, because the animal isn't going to walk away from you, isn't going to judge whatever that is. But I don't think that necessarily that doesn't mean there's a human there for that person, but it's just that the dogs or the cats or the pets offer that something to that relationship that the humans can't.
That's fascinating. I'm going to bring Aisha back in if we could, because this strikes me as another point to what you were saying, and this is sort of another quote. The path to health, especially mental and social health, lies in our empathetic relations with others. It strikes me that just what Clarissa was saying, that there might be those who say, well, you can't really have an empathetic relationship with a non-human because it's a one-way street. That is, there's very little risk of rejection from my dog or cat. And so there's almost a cynical element to it. Well, that's not really healthy. You're just taking advantage of the fact that the dog can't really talk. There's a projection. Is that Aisha? Is that in play?
Oh no, absolutely not. Because other animals aren't just—they're not mirrors of us. They're their own beings. They have their own internal lives, their own minds, and way of thinking of things. And how they are with us is—they react to how we are with them. So it's not like they just reflect. They react to us. So how if you're kind, if you're at peace, if you're feeling calm, the animals will react to that as well. And if you're the opposite, if you're mean, if you're cruel to them, they'll react to that as well. So that's empathy, at play, because when we're bonding with animals, we are learning not just how the animals are with us, but we're learning how to be with the animals. Mm-hmm. Because we're learning that our own body language, the way we speak, the way we stand, the way we interact with the animal can worsen or improve that bond, mm-hmm, with the animal. And so that is when we're learning how our behaviors are, how our behaviors affect the other animal, that we're, in a sense, that is empathy. We're looking at the animal's point of view, and we're trying to understand from their eyes, what are they seeing and what are they experiencing.
Clarissa, would you say that part of what happens when you match a dog with a veteran is the learning, the two of them learning what Aisha was just talking about? Is that part of the process? It seems to me that would be a critical.
Absolutely.
Right? So
it's a huge part of the process.
And do you supervise that? Do you follow up on that? How do you watch that learning process?
Yes. So what we do, we work with our veterans and we teach them sort of what we've been working on with the animals. So we're teaching them something, positive reinforcement, non-force based, and how that relationship should be based on mutual trust and respect. And so we spend, our veterans become part of the Pets for Vets family. So we are always checking in on them, making sure that bond is there, that super bond that we're talking about is there. And we offer any advice or help and to make sure and encourage that. But it definitely is something that we are part of for the lifetime of the pet and that veteran.
Do you ever worry that stress, and this could be for either one, stress has the potential to play out in an unpredictable way. And I'm thinking a person who may be suffering from PTSD or any of those afflictions could become unpredictably violent. You know, that like they could go into a rage. I mean, I've anecdotally, you know, seen these and read about these incidents. Is there ever any jeopardy to the dog, that the unpredictability of the degree of the stress that that the veteran may have encountered could potentially pose a risk to the dog? Have you ever had
it? It's a good question. So what I like to say is we all have something, right? So I know we're talking about PTSD right now, and I think, you know, anecdotally maybe you've heard some of that, but that doesn't mean if you have PTSD that is how you respond to mm-hmm. PTSD. Mm-hmm. And every human has something that's going on, and we all respond unpredictably. So for us personally, we are looking for a dog that will fit into that person. We get to know our veterans very well, find out what is going on with them, how they respond when they do feel triggered, what that looks like, and we're finding a dog that fits. But our entire process is also about making sure that whatever animal is being placed, that they're safe and at home.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking even, Aisha, going back to you, like the uncle who abused Sylvester. Now, that was a cultural thing, but suppose he had, it was a similar thing where he wanted to be kind to Sylvester, but he had some sort of triggering thing going on there as well, that he couldn't control it. How would you control and manage or advise a situation like that where the animal is potentially seems to be, he's in a really friendly and comfortable home. In fact, the Sylvester was, right? Sylvester was in a nice home, but we had this uncle who was basically beating the crap out of him, right? Unpredictably. I don't know, what do you do with that? What do you do with that unpredictable nature that's in humans and regarding the safety of the dog?
Well, that's always going to be, you know, a question because it's hard to know when those things are going to happen. I will say I don't really find that to be the case with people with PTSD. I've never heard or of any soldier with PTSD, for example, abusing an animal. It's not to say that it can't happen or it hasn't happened, but if it does, it's definitely not a common thing. And I think, you know, with it's rooting out, finding out those pockets of violence is part of what we have to do as a society. It's because we know that abuse of animals is so often linked with other forms of abuse. And to be honest, I don't know what my uncle was going through at the time when he was abusing Sylvester. He might have been abused as well. We never really spoke about it, and that was unfortunate part of it. But he might have been being abused as well. He might have been being bullied at school. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
But you could have, I could see the two reactions where, you know, he's being abused. This is really classic stuff, right? If you're abused by a parent or something, well, what do? You go ahead and take it out on something more helpless than you, i.e. the dog. Or you have the opposite reaction where you've been abused and the last thing you want to do is be abusive. You want to be the healer. You want to be the common. It seems like that's really what you're looking for. Clarissa, that's what you're looking for, right? That's exactly what, you know, people who have suffered this stress, we want them to not act out. We want them to see the relationship with the dog as a healing relationship, right? And
correct.
That's the challenge. And how do you do that? How do you make sure that they're on one side of that equation and not the other? Or can you?
Yeah, so this is a part of our process. This isn't just a quick, all right, we've met somebody, let's go get a dog. We really spend a lot of time getting to know our veterans, talking to friends, to family, to their care providers, to veterinarians. So we're getting an entire picture of who our veteran is and what it is that they're looking for. And so that we can make sure that when we're placing an animal, that it's good for both the human and the animal.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could, we only have a couple minutes left. I love the story of the one veteran with the paw. Could you give us another one? I just a success story where we had, I mean, you must be jam-packed with him, but that yep. healing process is so it's so positive, it's so encouraging. Just leave us with another one if you would.
Yeah. So one of my favorite stories is from a veteran who was having difficulty with sleeping, and he had not had a good night's sleep since he had returned from Iraq. And so we had known that, and part of that was nightmares, that nightmares were causing him a lot of stress at night. So he wasn't sleeping, he was waking up. So when looking for his dog, we found a really wonderful dog for him, but we also trained her for a nightmare behavior to teach her to wake up him up at night if he was having this nightmare. When they got together for their first time, when he met her, you could just hear this audible sigh of relief. Mm-hmm. He just let out this huge breath, and he lay down on her bed with her, held her paw, and took a nap right there with her. But what was so amazing was because of the super bond and the connection that we had, she was waking him up from those nightmares that he was having. But because he now felt safe, he now knew that she was looking out for him, he became more relaxed, and he actually started to have fewer and fewer and fewer nightmares because he knew she was there for him and he was starting to get a good night's sleep.
Oh, that's amazing. Are they still are they still together, as far as you know?
They're still together and going strong.
That's
yep.
great. That's great. Okay. I want to thank Aisha Akhtar. Again, the book is Our Symphony with Animals on Health, Empathy, and Our Shared Destinies. And Clarissa Black with Pets for Vets. And Clarissa, if there's any way that our listeners can help, where can we tell them? How can they help out?
Yes, please go to our website, petsforvets.com. That's pets. forvets.com, and you can go on if you're interested in donating or becoming a volunteer in a local chapter. We have 27 chapters across the country.
Do we have one here in Philadelphia?
Look forward to hearing from you. We do have a few nearby, yes.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you again to our guests. And we will be right back with Dr. Tom Picard and Ask the Vet. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet good care of us, but would rather stay home, would rather be home to catch mice.
And we're back on the Other Animals with WWDB. And we are talking with Tom Picard. So Tom, we were a little bit rushed last week, and we got on the subject of pain management for pets. And I'm happy to announce, by the way, we have our iTunes podcast up and rolling, and so we have a listener on one of the podcasts. I hope it's okay to use her name on the air. It's Crystal Hegedus from Richmond. And she wanted us to, she had a follow-up question on this notion of pain and pain management. And in her case, it's dealing with cats. And she wants to know that cats seem to be able to hide when they're in pain. Should I give them something to help even if they're not actively showing that they're in pain? I thought that's kind of an interesting question because as a cat owner myself, I know that cats will do everything they can not to reveal that they're in some sort of pain because, as I know from, living in their wild roots, that showing pain is a sign of weakness and vulnerability. So they try to hide it for as long as they can. But the question is, I think what Crystal is asking is if you know as a human that they're in some kind of pain, is it okay to intervene at that point?
Yeah, I mean, the hiding of illness in animals is pretty common, especially you'll see it in birds a lot too. They just don't want to be victimized by their fellow species members who see them weak and they just, find it that they're a victim. But as far as I wouldn't just assume your cat or dog or other pet is in pain based on behavior and medicate them without, certainly consulting with the vet and seeing if there's an underlying problem that does need to be treated.
Yeah.
Hiding could be a cause, a symptom of being maybe uncomfortable in pain, not feeling well. could be just being afraid of something too, a noise or whatever. So, I mean, I wouldn't just medicate him all, right off the bat without getting him evaluated.
Cool. All right. I hope that helps, Crystal. Tom, I'm curious, listening to our callers today, if you have any, have you seen anything like what they're talking, where you have this person that has seen some kind of a stress, where that bond, where the bond with the human and the dog or cat has done something on a deeper level than you might have seen with just normal pet ownership. I'm putting my pet ownership up in air quotes. I mean, you must have seen quite a quiz.
I do, one particular client I have, I don't know that she was in any sort of military service whatsoever, but or not. excuse me, but I know since I've known her for a long time, she's been wheelchair bound, and her dog started to have some pretty bizarre and strange leg problems as well, and to the point where it really was bordering on whether, you know, euthanasia might be necessary, because I really wasn't sure if anything was going to be able to help him. But particularly her condition made her, I think, inspired to do everything she could for her dog, because she empathized for what he was going through because of what her own condition was. Oh. So, and he's gotten a fair amount of help. There's a WAGS. It's a one I can't remember off the top of my head. But anyway, they do a lot of water therapy and things like that for animals with leg injuries and things like that, or leg conditions. And it seems to have been helping them.
So in her case, it wasn't that that she was worried for her own safety. She was actually empathizing with the dog.
Yeah, I think maybe an owner who wasn't, you know, in a situation where they were maybe wheelchair bound, maybe they would have leaned another direction with this dog and seen that maybe there's nothing I feel like I can do. My dog's in pain. I don't want them to be in pain. I guess this is the end. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas other owners who are completely normally ambulatory would take care of their pet too.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. I definitely want to thank our guests again. That was Aisha Akhtar and Clarissa Black. For a downloadable podcast of today's show, or if you have any ideas or suggestions for future guests or subjects or information on advertising on the animals, please go to theotheranimals.com. Next week, The Children Shall Lead. We'll talk with author Gail Melson of Why the Wild Things Are, about why children like Elena Hidalgo naturally love children and how we can foster that. We will see you then. Thanks, everyone.